Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Batflips and Nerds, the podcast that brings you a British take on baseball. This week I'm joined by Ben Carter and Tom Pringle. And this week we've got a two-part podcast. The first part of that podcast will be mine and Tom's interview with ESPN International's Thomas Newman, who talked to us earlier on this evening about the Great Britain baseball team's World Baseball Classic qualifier exploits last week in Brooklyn. And then shortly after that, we will come back and we'll introduce a new recurring feature for the podcast, which we're all taking part in. And finally, we'll round it up with some World Series predictions. So without further ado, here's our interview with Thomas Newman. So Tom and I are here and we're joined by Thomas Newman. Thomas is a writer for ESPN International and he's joining us this evening to have a quick conversation about the World Baseball Classic qualifier in Brooklyn, which took place last week, which by now all of you know the GB team took part in and managed to reach the final, where they unfortunately lost out 9-1 to a very strong Israel team. So good evening to you, Thomas.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, good afternoon. You're in Florida, so it's the afternoon. It's the evening here in London.
Yes, that is correct.
So before we started recording, you were just telling me about your general impressions of the event last weekend in Brooklyn. So how about we start there? You said you didn't really know what to expect, but you came away thinking it was a really fun event. So do you mind just telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you have a certain amount of pageantry and some of the, you know, the flags and the anthems and national pride. And so that's kind of an entry point. Ultimately, all these guys are competitors. And when it gets down to putting the ball in play, I think that's what it's all about. But there was just kind of the added stakes of the national pride involved. And, you know, these guys may not all be at the level of major league ball players, but personally as a spectator, I think it's just as compelling, if not more compelling, because of just the investment that these guys have and the, you know, just the effort and the emotions that go along with it. And from talking to all of the teams during the practices leading up to the competition, it was also interesting in that none of these teams really had a great idea where they stood. I think there was a feeling that Israel was probably the favorite based on having, 19 or 21 players affiliated with major league teams and a few major league veterans. After that, I think it was kind of unknown whether Brazil or Great Britain was the second best team. Obviously, Pakistan competing for the first time was probably thought to be the weakest team based on experience. But it was kind of cool to see, you know, you have to go into this thing thinking we're going to win. We're the best team here. And so, you know, it was cool to see these teams come in and they're not necessarily even.
Yeah, great. So I'm sorry, just to sort of pick up on something.
I'm rambling. Cut me off.
Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were pausing to contemplate or if you'd finish your thought. But if I could just pick up on something you mentioned there about how all the guys are really, really proud to play under their flag. I wanted to just touch on that briefly from a GB point of view. One of the things that came across in all of your articles and certainly in our coverage of the team and the conversation that we had with Liam before the event was about the GB way. Like, he had a particular way he wanted the team to play and a particular way he wanted them to conduct themselves. And was that something that you saw come across over the time that you spent with the GB team? What did you see this bunch of guys really embracing the opportunity?
Yeah, I absolutely saw that. And I think, you know, in speaking with Liam, he, I'm sure, shared the same thoughts with you, but I think he wants to run a relatively tight ship and ultimately play mistake-free baseball as a result of it. And, you know, I think it kind of starts at the top with preparation and just being mentally prepared and knowing what to do when you get there. I think that's kind of the end result he was looking for. And I definitely saw that. You know, he had a challenge in that I think they had about 9 players of Bahamian background that he didn't really have much of a chance to work with prior. But that said, I thought he assembled it well on the fly.
Yeah, well, just sort of taking on from there, I specifically wanted to ask you about Liam because from a distance, and you know, we've gotten to know Liam a little bit over the course of the last couple of months, but from a distance, he seemed to take a very different approach and be a very different coach to his counterparts from Brazil and from Israel, especially in Barry Larkin and Jerry Weinstein. I kind of felt that some of the coverage of Liam was slightly unfair. It dwelt on his lack of experience rather than the fact that he was very thorough and he took a very different approach. He had, you know, these slogans. He had slogans coming out of his ears in some respects. What were your impressions of Liam as a guy? Because you got to spend some time with him during the practices and during the first day of the tournament.
Yeah. I tend to think that anybody that would draw an impression and criticize his tactics based on a couple of games, that I think that's probably going to be unfair in any event. But I was impressed. I thought he was very businesslike. I think it's a little different situation for him than Barry Larkin or Jerry Weinstein, in that he's been involved with that team since, I believe, 1996. So, I mean, he is fully invested for 2 decades. That's, you know, Barry Larkin's been with Brazil for about 5 years, I want to say, which is a pretty good run, but he's not a Brazil native. He doesn't have that investment. And so I think Liam has a much different perspective. And, you know, I think I was kind of watching along and I pretty much agreed with most of the moves he made. You know, you could question the way they looked at the pitching or whatnot. You know, do you go all in on the first game? And I tended to agree with what he did. And so I think that kind of criticism is probably unfair.
I mean, it wasn't so much criticism, although there has been some of that, but there were some dispatches that felt it important to note the fact that he had relatively little experience in minor league or major league ball in comparison to his illustrious opposition. I just thought it was a slightly strange take when he came and he put a lot of himself out there. He had some really interesting ideas. He, you know, very well developed thoughts. He managed to bring a team together quite quickly. And, you know, you mentioned there he's a very, very businesslike character and, you know, this really is his life. I thought it was, and I mean, was that evident to you? It seems like it was.
I would agree with that. And I mean, you can look at baseball in a number of ways. Some of the greatest, if not most of the greatest managers in major league history were not great players. A lot of times, and I don't know Liam's background. I've looked at his resume, but the fact that he hasn't played minor league or major league baseball, I don't know that that's the barometer for success. You know, he clearly has the background and a lot of experience at other levels. And I think you can just as easily gain the strategic experience that way. You know, it's a matter of repetition. And so the level of experience is, you know, it's different. But in a competition like this, I don't know that that's a disadvantage.
Was Liam sort of drawing on the guys around him? Obviously, he had some very experienced coaches with him, but was he also drawing along some experience from the players as well that were surrounding him, especially some of the minor leaguers, for example?
Yeah, it was tough for me to maybe necessarily pick up on that. I would assume that that's the case. You know, basically, one of the nice things about baseball is that to a certain extent, you can do a plug and play with your roster. You can throw guys in and just kind of let it ride. You don't necessarily have to draw up game plans or run all kinds of strategy. A lot of it is, you know, go for it and play. And if you have a talented player, you let him do his thing. You know, it's a challenge in many ways to put a team together very quickly. But I think I would applaud the way he did it. I mean, it certainly looked like all the players were on the same page to me.
And what were your general perceptions of the GB program that you took away from your time in Brooklyn and your time watching the team, and both in terms of the team that you saw there over the weekend and the any broader gleanings that you had about this country, our country's approach to the game?
I don't want to dodge the question, but it's a little bit difficult for me to say just because a lot of these guys might have been Americans with a parental connection to Britain or Bahamian players. And so they are not players that would be representing Britain in, say, the European Championships or whatnot. But I can go back to, like we said earlier, the passion involved, just the devotion and the investment in a lot of these guys. And, you know, as just a fan of the sport of baseball, that's really refreshing to see. And, you know, I certainly hope that it's something that is growing in Great Britain and on that side of the Atlantic. And I love to see that.
In terms of, you know, maybe you can be a bit of a neutral third party on this question. I wrote a piece after the tournament had ended last week about how we as a country had maybe gained an armful of heroes and people to follow through their careers who we maybe didn't realize we had before the weekend had started. And that got some criticism from some quarters who felt that the fact that the Bahamians and some of the Americans who were on the squad had taken away an opportunity from a British player or someone playing in the British representational league. Just putting aside this being Great Britain, do you have a view on that rule within the World Baseball Classic? You know, the association rule that you can play for a team which is where your ancestors have come from. Do you think it's a good thing in terms of spreading coverage and giving different countries opportunities to raise profile and get better?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, right? I would tend to say that my opinion is I do think it's good. On the surface level, it is kind of odd to see that maybe half the roster is from the United States or the Bahamas. But when you boil it down, and I mean, you can look at the Israel roster, and I believe they had two citizens, and one did not play. And one is a lifelong American, but he does have dual citizenship through his parents. But I think ultimately, and Major League Baseball runs this as opposed to the world governing body, Major League Baseball wants to spread the game, and it's counterproductive for them to have other teams come in and just get pounded because they don't have the same participation numbers or history and experience. And so I kind of like, once I've given it some thought, I kind of like that rule. I think there's a much better opportunity to grow the game that way. I could see from a British perspective, if you want to see homegrown players, I could see a frustration with that. But, you know, in terms of competition, I don't think there's anybody who's in a better position to judge the level of talent and put together the best roster than Liam Carroll. And I'm sure he took all of that into consideration. And, you know, obviously he's trying to win because that's ultimately what's going to help him spread the word of that program. So, you know, when it boils down to it, it's a little bit odd on the surface level, but I do like it.
Yeah, and I think the other point that can't be made too strongly is that what was clear that was whether these guys thought this or not before they arrived, they clearly were very proud of the fact that they were wearing that Great Britain name on their chest, and they were just having a really fun time representing the country and playing together, which was really lovely to see for someone sat 3,000 miles away watching it through a computer screen.
I can tell you without exception that those guys cared. Maybe they were American citizens per se, but I don't think they took their connections lightly. They absolutely cared about the GB on the front of their uniforms.
Brilliant, thanks. And just one last question for me, and then Tom can chip in if he has any others. You watched the team over the weekend. You watched them in the instructs and in practice. Were there any of the GB players who you saw, albeit in a short time, small sample size and all that, who you thought there's real potential there? That's a guy who the GB guys can hang their hat on and perhaps see him in the major leagues in a few years' time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a scout, so take what I say with a grain of salt. But I was impressed with the young pitcher from Scotland who I believe grew up in the Houston area, Nolan Bond. He came in and threw some relief from University of Houston. Obviously, somebody like Michael Roth, who started the first game, he has a little bit of major league experience already with Angels and Rangers. And he looked really good against Israel in that first game. If it weren't for the pitch count rules, I wonder if Liam would have loved to bring him back on Sunday against Israel, maybe gone a little bit shorter with him on Thursday. Let's see. The Bahamian players were extremely athletic. If you saw that game, I was very impressed by their speed. I mean, you can just tell watching these guys. They just kind of jump off the field at you with their speed running the bases and in the field. So I would say of those guys, Champ Stewart and Chavez Young especially looked promising. Young players. And those were probably the guys right there that really impressed me the most.
Okay, that's interesting. I think we probably have taken those names ourselves as well. I think Jazz Chisholm, from my perspective, maybe is slightly unlucky to miss out on your list, but I didn't have Nolan Todd, but I had the other three on my list too. I had one other question, and it's been a bit of an imponderable for me over the course of the last week. It's a bit of a what if question, and you may not be aware of this, Thomas, and by all means, don't fall on either side of the fence. Was Jacob Esch's timely call up to the Miami Marlins the difference between this GB team winning and losing in that last game, or indeed in the first game? Because he would probably have pitched game one, I would expect.
That's a great question. Gosh, I would just be speculating. I mean, I would want to say no, it wasn't the difference, because I can't imagine Liam Carroll would want to make an excuse, and I certainly wouldn't want to take away from the team that was there. And they played extremely well. I mean... That team played extremely well. Even the Sunday game, it turned out to be 9-1, but they were in there until the fifth inning. One pitch got away, and then, you know, baseball, it's like a snowball going downhill. But that game was much closer than 9-1. Selfishly, I'm sure Liam would have loved to have a guy like Jake Esch. You know, you've got one more just a starting pitcher to anchor your team around, and that certainly could be the difference. But by the same token, I asked Liam about that, and you know, he said, look, I mean, that is him being called up to the Marlins is something that we can, you know, hang the hat of our program on. We can point to guys who have represented this team and are now in the major leagues. And you know, you bring youngsters up in the game and show them that, and that's how you grow your program. So I'd be speculating, you know, in my heart, I want to say no, it didn't make the difference, because the guys who were there played extremely well. And ultimately, boy, you look at that Israel roster. They had, 19, 21 guys with affiliated experience. It's a pretty darn good team. So I would tend to say they would love to have him, but that Israel team was pretty darn good.
Okay, great. I think you're probably right. Tom, any more questions from you?
No, I've got nothing. Thomas, it was brilliant just to hear about the fact that the GB guys, excuse me, the GB guys, no matter where they were from, were just so proud to wear that jersey and go out there and do it. It was great for us to watch and enjoy. And it's been really good to hear from you.
So all that remains is for us to say thank you to Thomas for your time. I think we can find you on Twitter at TNN95. That's correct.
That is correct.
Great. So we'll all follow you. It might be another 4 years until you're covering the GB baseball squad again, but hopefully we'll still be following you then. Right. And in part two of the podcast, we're going to start, as we always do, by touching on the big news stories this week in baseball. And it's been just over a week and a half since we last spoke to you. Our last episode was our interview with Jordan Serena before the World Baseball Classic. And in the intervening time period, as you will all no doubt be aware, tragedy has hit the world of baseball with the loss of one of its brightest shining stars, Jose Fernandez, the 24-year-old pitcher with the Miami Marlins. We're not going to talk about Jose Fernandez this evening, except to just say we were all huge fans of his. He was one of the players who made us all love baseball. Instead, rather than us dwelling on it, I'd like to point you to a couple of brilliant pieces which you can find online, which say everything that we would say now and say it better. Those are by Jeff Passan and by Meg Rowley. There are many others. We've read them all. Those stand out amongst the crowd. So go away and find those and learn all about Jose Fernandez over again and bring a smile to your face. So instead of Jose Fernandez, we're going to go from the quite literally sublime to the ridiculous and talk about the revolving door already being in full purpose and full swing in the world of managerial and front office changes. And we'll start with the man who quite literally did knock at, you're not laughing, Walt Weiss, the Colorado Rockies manager, who this week tendered his resignation to the Rockies. And Ben, what's your take on that as our Rockies man here? What do you think about Walt Weiss going? Did he jump before he was pushed?
As the resident Rockies fan, yeah. I had a bit of bittersweet feelings about Walt Weiss. I don't think he was awful, Rockies manager. There's definitely a feeling of jump before he was pushed on this one. A lot's been said about his deteriorating relationship with general manager Jeff Riddick. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Those two apparently did not get on particularly well, especially this year. And I think at this point, Riddick wants to take the organization in a direction that does not include Weiss, which isn't hugely surprising. It was the first Rockies 75-win season since 2010, which is a damning indictment of the franchise, but speaks to the way that the team is improving slowly. So though Weiss might feel a little aggrieved, he hasn't got a chance to see his team grow into something special. But for the Rockies fans, I think we all agree that this needs to be successful. There has to be someone else in charge for the time being. It'll be interesting to see who they go for.
Yeah, it definitely will. I wonder who you could bring in that's going to take it in a fundamentally different direction. But then, what do I know? Maybe they can get someone who stops the ball spinning in certain ways, pushes the fences back even further, and gets them to hit more, even more dingers. We'll wait and see. That's one to watch. The other big news on the front office front, oh God, that's horrible syntax, but there we are. It's out there now. Was in Arizona, the Rockies NL West neighbors, where manager Chip Hale and GM Dave Stewart both hit the buffers with Stuart leaving in classic fashion by saying he had better things to do with his time anyway. That's what you get when you've got lots of different business interests. But one man who does cling on is podcast favorite Tony La Russa, at least for the time being. He's still there. And I don't know if either of you guys had any thoughts on what's going on in Arizona. I mean, it's a well-needed broom, but how is Tony La Russa surviving it?
It's as you said, it's a well-needed broom, but there's got to be some wholesale changes there. I mean, I can imagine at the moment Zach Greinke is just looking in the mirror and thinking, yeah, it's lovely to have all this money, but what a mess that I've walked into. I mean, what is their plan? What are they going to do?
Well, hopefully they're going to get better, but they might have to get worse before they get better. I can see this being a bit of a shake-up this off-season in Arizona, and I'm not talking about our friend who we're going to come on to in a moment, who's going to shake up the Arizona Fall League. We'll see. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of their big players, the Corbins and the Goldschmidts, maybe exiting stage right this summer in order to try and right that ship. But one to watch. So there we go. That was the week in baseball. We're going to come on to talk about the playoffs later on, so we'll park that for the time being. I hope we've all got our brackets sorted and we can have a discussion about who's going to make an impression over the course of the next 3.5 weeks. But before we do, much more importantly, before we come on to our playoff brackets, we have got another new feature that we're going to introduce. It's going to be a perennial feature on the podcast, at least across the autumn. It's going to keep us all interested as organized baseball winds down and comes to an end. It's the League of Instructional Leaguers. Now, Tom, this was your brainchild, so I want you to explain what is the League of Instructional Leaguers and why the hell have you invented it?
As the T-Bone news was coming out, it all looked a bit sad for all the other instructional fall leaguers that were there, who were complaining about the fact that, well, I didn't get this sign-on bonus, I don't get all these special additions to my contract, I don't get to have the summer off so I can go and cover college football or whatever it may be. So I thought maybe it's worthwhile adopting a fall leaguer and following his progress and trying to ensure that he gets a similar coverage as best as we can to T-Bone and try and let everyone know when he hits a dinger in batting practice, or, you know, when he takes a bite of a burrito. So everyone in the world can know that our adopted instructional leaguer is going to get that. I think, you know, for just £5 a month, you can adopt your very own instructional leaguer, and it will make a difference to their life.
So, yeah, we'll all be adopting our own instructional leaguer, and we're going to encourage anyone following the podcast on Twitter and on Facebook to do the same. And we'll be providing you with as regular updates as it's possible to glean from the absolutely fundamentally desperate coverage of the instructional leagues other than Tim Tebow and the internet. We'll be keeping you up to date as best we can. Of course, Tebow has already won the instructional leagues because he's the man who gets to look like a comic book hero whilst wearing a hat with Mr. Met on it. So no one's going to beat him in that game anyway. If you haven't looked at pictures of Tebow wearing a Mr. Met hat, go away and do it now. It's a treat. But placing Tebow to one side, we wanted to benchmark things against a player who's playing in the instructional leagues who is of some pedigree and some quality. That player is going to be allocated to one of our team, and that's Will Cook, who unfortunately can't join us this week. So Will is in the lucky position of having his own instructional leaguer to follow, which is Tyler Nevin. Tyler Nevin is a third baseman in the Colorado Rockies franchise. He was a first-round supplemental pick. He has been injured for the last couple of years, but has very huge promise and probably is, alongside Tim Tebow, one of the blue-chip players playing in the Arizona Instructional League this year. The reason that we've decided that Tyler Nevin is going to be our benchmark player this year is two reasons, and I chose it. Firstly, he's got two surnames, and my mum mistrusts anyone with two surnames, so I chose Tyler Nevin as a great tribute to her. And secondly, he shares a surname with the former Everton and Chelsea left winger Pat Nevin, who, like me, is a huge fan of the 80s band, the Cocteau Twins. So, Tyler, you've got a lot to live up to, and Will, you're very lucky to have Tyler. And going on from there, how about you, Ben? Who have you picked?
I have picked an Atlanta Braves young prospect named Mike Soroka, a right-hander. He's only 19 years of age. A lot of people instruct him as very young. I decided to roll with him this year because he's had a very impressive stat line as part of a very impressive Braves single-A team who actually won their single-A championship this year. They had a three-headed monster at the top of their rotation, three huge prospects. And Soroka is the least heralded of the three, but goes to instruction with a decent amount of hype behind him now, at least among Braves fans. So I'm going to be watching him closely, seeing how he does. I'm sure the big instructional season, he'll start hitting prospects this next season.
Great. And Darius again, unfortunately, can't join us this evening. He's got held up, but he has given us the name of his member of the League of Instructional Leaguers. And that, unsurprisingly, is a San Francisco Giants prospect, Anthony Marks. Now, Darius's reasons for choosing Anthony Marks were, firstly, he was undrafted from Coastal Carolina College, although he did play a part in the College World Series. He was particularly interested to see how an undrafted player would come along. The other interesting thing about Marks is that he's 5'8", so he's pretty small. We are seeing a renaissance of the small man in Major League Baseball this year with the likes of Lindor and obviously Altuve breaking through and having excellent seasons to go alongside the perennially brilliant tiny man, Dustin Pedroia. So let's see how Anthony Marks does doing it for the small man in the instructional leagues this summer, this autumn even. And Tom, what about you? Who have you got?
Well, I went for San Diego Padres left-hand pitcher, old man Joey Lucchesi. I've probably destroyed his last name there. Now, he's the old man of the instructional league roster for the Padres at 23, so I thought that was the most interesting thing. He was a fourth-round pick out of, let me load up his baseball reference page, Southeast Missouri State University. So that was a fourth-round pick in 2016. Left-hand pitcher. He started 10 games, lost two. As we know with single-A baseball and that side of things, he's not going to be going the distance in those. So he's got an ERA of 1.29, 42 innings pitched, 56 strikeouts, 3 walks. So that's 12 strikeouts per 9. Looking through his Twitter feed, which was obviously one of the most important features for me, he's a big Golden State Warriors fan, so he's going to be pretty unbearable this whole season. He enjoys funny vines and GIFs. He was the D1 Baseball Pitcher of the Year at one point. And he's at Joey Fuego 44. So clearly, sticking with the effectively wild, all baseball players aren't funny. Joey Fuego 44.
Right. So we'll keep an eye out for Joey Fuego. And mine, I made a rather last minute decision on this morning. But when I finally trolled around and looked at lots of different write ups of players going to the instructional league, I couldn't not choose this individual. That is the ornately and brilliantly named Ranyelmi Alberto. Now, our friend Ranyelmi is like our very good friend Jordan Serena in the Los Angeles Angels organization and spent last year playing for the Burlington Bees alongside Jordan. The difference between Jordan and Ranyelmi is not just that the latter is going to be in Arizona this autumn. It's that he played this year as an outfielder and will be spending the instructional league transitioning to be a pitcher. Yes, he's one of those reclamation projects. He hit 228 this year in Burlington, so bless him, clearly wasn't going to go anywhere on that talent, but apparently has a bit of a cannon for an arm and they're trying to turn him from a thrower into a pitcher. So watch this space. Another Burlington B for us all to get behind. So that's it. That's our League of Instructional Leaguers. Anyone can join. We'll be putting details up on our Twitter feed after we release this podcast. If you want to join the League of Instructional Leaguers, just tell us who your pick is, where they're playing, and we'll keep an eye out for them. You can do it too, and there'll be regular updates on the podcast and also on the blog too. Before we move on from the man who sits underneath Mr. Met, Tim Tebow, I just wondered, guys, if you could think of any other fictional character other than the fictional character of superhero Christian Tim Tebow who you would like to see given a shot in instructionals. Tom, how about you? Which fictional character do you think should be in instructionals?
The obvious one, Inspector Gadget. He could cover the whole field. He's got long enough arms to catch the balls if needs be. But if instructionals did DHs, then I'd have to take Bungle from Rainbow. He's a big guy. He's got a big swing on him. And I think he'd make a difference to a team.
I love it. Inspector Gadget would definitely be a five-tool player. No. Ben, how about you?
I can't really think of anyone who would be my fictional character who would tear up the instructional league. I think Inspector Gadget is a great shout. But you have to give me a chance to come back with something good next week. So I'm not coming up with anything right now.
All right, we'll come back to you next week. Mine is going to be Pennywise the Clown from the Stephen King book and film adaptation. And that's because scary clowns are in the news these days, and I thought it was the only way that you could potentially get more click throughs than Tim Tebow for an instructional league story would be to ally the phenomenon of people dressing as scary clowns with instructional league baseball. So there you go, Pennywise the Clown. That's my choice of fictional character to have a go in instructionals. Right, so that farce out of the way. Let's move on to some real baseball chat and let's get going on the playoffs. So your brackets are chosen. Everyone's in place. Boston are going to win, obviously. Sorry, Ben, you're going to have to hold back this levy. We'll start not in Boston, though. We'll start in San Francisco, who have made heavy weather of getting to the playoffs, but finally sealed the deal over the weekend and go into the NL wildcard game tomorrow evening with Madison Bumgarner on the hill, facing off in a phenomenal pitcher's duel against the New York Mets' Noah Syndergaard. Guys, what do you make of the Giants? Is it believing, again, as the hashtag has it, or is this going to be one and done for them?
I think it's hard to look beyond them, given their prestigious record in the playoffs in recent years. I'm not a big believer in believing. I think it's all a load of nonsense that Giants fans like to peddle. No offense to any Giants fans listening. But they do have a rock-solid rotation. They hit brilliantly in the first half of the season, atrociously in the second half. But in the playoffs, anything can happen. And I think in that one-game playoff, it's hard to look beyond them against the Mets. And from there, all it takes is a few decent starts. I mean, we don't know how good Bumgarner is in the postseason. So I think they have a decent chance. I think they're being a bit undersold at the moment just because of how bad they have been in the second half. But I would go a long way before I would choose them as my favourites because of another team in the NL that are fairly dominant at the moment.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Ben. I think that, I think they're under the radar. I mean, you can't want for a better pitcher than Madison Bumgarner in a one-and-done game. And that lineup still pretty good. I mean, Crawford, Pagan, these are good players. Buster Posey, of course, lest I forget Buster Posey. They can beat anyone. They can beat anyone in a one-game series. They can beat anyone in a five-game series, particularly now they've got Matt Moore and in the back of that rotation. I mean, that rotation is absolutely phenomenal. Bumgarner, Cueto, Samardzija, Matt Moore. That's as good a four-man rotation as you're going to see on any playoff roster. The question is whether their bullpen can hold up. Yeah. On the topic of which, Tom, the Red Sox bullpen has again fallen to pieces after an amazing month of September. Is it going to be the thorn in Dave Dombrowski's heel yet again?
It was for me, everyone was talking about the rotation last year and getting it sorted, but for me it was the bullpen. I mean, you looked at the Royals last year and every time their bullpen came in, that the game was done. You weren't going to go anywhere. But the Red Sox bullpen always made me nervous. I mean, for runs allowed, they're slightly above league average at the minute. They're pretty average for whip, pretty average for walks and strikeouts to walks. But the relief pitchers, if we're looking at WAR, they're 0.3 WAR compared to the rest of the league itself. So they're hardly anything. Some other interesting things that popped up. Entering the game with the bases empty. So this is the relievers entering the game with the bases empty 309 times. That's the lowest. So they're few and far between when the pitchers are coming in compared to the rest of the league. Entering the game runners on, eighth highest. Inherited score percentage. So we're talking entering the game with runners on, who then eventually score. These are the relief pitchers. 33%, that's the eighth highest. I mean, the bullpen just doesn't strike fear at all anymore. I mean, Kimbrel's been shaky a few times quite recently. Are they going to start involving Koji more, maybe looking at him to close? Tozawa. It doesn't strike me with fear or build me confidence. For me, the Red Sox, they've got to go for the old Brazil of the 90s playing football. We will score more than you, and that's that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're absolutely right. Craig Kimbrel, over the course of this weekend, if you haven't been looking at his box scores, don't, because it's even more terrifying than Pennywise the Clown at the Instructional League. So, we are avoiding the elephant in the room. Ben, you alluded to it. Chicago Cubs, can anyone beat them?
I mean, as you mentioned before, in a one-game or a five-game or a seven-game series, anyone can win. And interestingly enough, in recent history, last 20 years or so, the team with the most wins in regular season has rarely gone on to win the World Series, mostly just because of the fact you have to beat at least three teams over a five or seven game series just to get there. So I think, although the Cubs go in rightly as favourites, it's a bit too early to crown them, especially given the fact that teams that go into the postseason hot don't tend to perform that well in the postseason. They'll be facing a couple of teams who have strong rotations. I've already mentioned how strong the Giants' rotation is. I mean, the Dodgers, at the very least, are going to get to throw Kershaw out there twice. And who knows who they'll be facing in the World Series if they do get there. So whilst I'd say they are rightly favourites, I think it's a little bit early to say they're going to be cruising their way to the playoffs. But it should certainly be a lot of fun this year, especially if they do get close. But with that 108-year drought to break. So I'm going to be rooting for them, at least for the first couple of rounds.
Great. What about you, Tom? Do you buy into the Cubs? Are you all in for Grandpa Rossi?
The team that I thought could stop the Cubs would be the Cardinals. I really believe that. And I remember chatting to a friend about it recently, and I said, for me, if the Cardinals get in, they're the ones that are going to stop the Cubs and potentially go all the way, just on that crest of the wave. But looking back at the stats for the year, it's actually the Mets that have got a pretty good record against the Cubs. So if they can beat the best pitcher in postseason baseball tomorrow night, then you never know. They could stop them, but, I mean, all the pressure is on the Cubs this year. No other team has got the pressure that the Cubs are feeling right now.
There we go. Right. So it's time, I think, to put our money where our mouth is. We sit around doing a lot of talking about baseball. I think it's time to put our necks on the line and tell you what our predictions are for the World Series. We're not going to do full brackets. I just want the two teams who are going to be in the World Series, and I want the team who's going to win and by what score. So I asked on our Twitter this morning for listeners to the podcast to give us their predictions, and we've had a couple. So Mark Blakemore, at Mark Blakemore on Twitter, thinks San Francisco take Boston 4-2 in the World Series. And Alan Shepard, who's at AJR Shepard on Twitter, he thinks the Red Sox are going to take the Cubs in Game 7 and be the team to ruin the dream yet again. The Red Sox beat Theo Epstein, they beat John Lester, and they beat David Ross. That strikes me as A, fanciful, and B, mean, which I suppose tells you a little bit which way I'm leaning. But how about you guys? We'll start with you, Tom. What's your World Series pairing and who's going to win?
Last November, I made a bet and I'm sticking with it. When the Giants emptied a lot of their payroll and opening up to get people like Cueto and Samardzija, I believe that the Giants were going to get there. Plus, it's even year magic, so they're going to get there. Their opponent, I believed, due to the fact the addition of David Price, Kimbrel, Carson Smith, I really did believe it was going to be the Red Sox. So the fact they've both got towards the end is a great start for me already. But I think even year magic beats all of the magic, and I just think the Giants are going to take it, and I think it's going to be 4-2.
Right. That's a pretty big shout. So you're going to go the same prediction as our listener Mark.
Oh, do you know right, what? No, I won't. I can't go the same as Mark, especially with him being a Yankees fan. So let's go 4-1. It's going to be a horrible match.
4-1. So you're going to dock
a horrible match for Boston.
That you're going to dock off an extra game for Boston just to spite a Yankees fan. Yeah. That's a tactic. Well, I'm pleased that my prediction is completely different from yours. I've gone a bit left field. Maybe I'm being a little bit wacky. I'm just thinking playoffs, right? I'm thinking literally anything could happen, and the anything that my crazed brain has come up with, even weirder than Pennywise the Clown, is the Texas Rangers and the Washington Nationals, and the Texas Rangers take that series 4-2. My rationale is that the Rangers have a really good rotation, the top two particularly being outstanding. They've got a really good lineup. They've got a lineup built for playoff baseball. They cause havoc on the bases. They take a lot of bases. You've got Beltre hitting cleanup. You've got Jonathan Lucroy, who's really solidified the lower middle of that order. And you've got a really underrated bullpen, like a bullpen that can really cause problems with Jeremy Jeffress, Sam Dyson, Jake Diekman. These are all excellent pitchers. And I think that everyone's kind of forgotten the fact that the Rangers have won an awful lot of close games this year. And sure, some of that's been luck, but a lot of it's been down to the fact that that bullpen's excellent. Washington, again, I think are just a bit of a sleeper pick. Their rotation, even without Strasburg, is excellent. They've got some really good players on the field. Harper, obviously, Daniel Murphy, who's been outstanding over the course of this year, and Trey Turner. I think Wilson Ramos will be a big miss for them, but I still think that they can beat anyone on their day. They can beat anyone over a 5-game series, just maybe not over a 7-game series. So that's my pick. Rangers 4, Nationals 2. Ben, how about you?
I'm afraid you've kind of stolen my thunder a bit, because I also have the Rangers doing a good job this postseason. My one thing I'm really looking forward to, if it comes to fruition, is a Rangers-Blue Jays ALDS. That was hands down the highlight of the postseason for me last season. When we had the Jose Bautista bat flip, we had the tension. And obviously earlier this season, we had Ruben Odor and Jose Bautista getting to know each other a little bit. So I think a replay of that would be an utterly stunning DS. And I think the Rangers would come out on top of that. So I have them going to the World Series on the American League side. The National League side, I won't say Cubs, I won't say Giants, but I went a little bit left field. I'm going to say, beyond all shadow of possible rational thought, the Mets are going to somehow get their way to the World Series through thick and thin, through battered pitching rotations, because they have a lineup that's actually swinging a pretty decent bat at the moment. They have these rookie pitchers who continue to defy all the odds and play in quality start after quality start, and I think they have a very underrated bullpen led by Familia, who Terry Collins has jokingly said he will actually use in important situations this postseason. So if, it's a big if, they can get past the Bumgarner challenge, I can see the Mets having a decent run, and I think they might actually win the whole thing if they get to the World Series. I have them beating the Rangers in 7 games.
Wow, that I really thought I'd gone out there, but you really are backing Kevin Gesellman, and why not?
Yep, why not? Gesellman and Lugo.
So there
World
we are.
Series winners.
Yeah, just to round it up, we've got Tom, you were taking the Giants to beat the Red Sox. I've got the Rangers beating the Nationals. And Ben has got the Mets beating the Rangers. Darius, I think we can safely assume, has the Giants winning everything. So we'll just pencil that one in for him. So that's it. That's us for today. We're going to go away and we're going to watch this evening's pitching duel between Chris Tillman and Marcus Stroman. Those of you on Twitter suggesting you'd rather have seen Francisco Liriano and Ubaldo Jimenez, wouldn't we all? And then tomorrow it's the main event for this week, I think. It's Bumgarner taking on Syndergaard. And it all goes from there and we all can't wait. So those are our predictions. Feel free to hold us to them. And we'll talk about them after the World Series has ended, but we'll be back in the intervening period, I'm absolutely sure.
Yeah, John, I've got breaking news. I'm really sorry.
You have?
Jump in there. We need to change our predictions completely.
Oh, yeah?
I've just had the alert from MLB.com. Clay Buchholz is starting game 3 for the Red Sox.
Whoa.
I'm having the Red Sox out in the first round, and Boston burning to the ground.
I'm having Cleandro Buchtinez clinching the ALDS for Boston. Well, there we go. So that's it for this week. On that, literally on that bombshell, to borrow from Jeremy Clarkson, we're going to end it. A few parish notices. As ever, you can find us on iTunes. Please give us a rating. It really does help get the podcast out to new listeners. Please tell a friend if you think a friend would like to learn a bit more about baseball. Tell them that we're the right place to start. You can get us on SoundCloud too. And there's been some new content on the blog over the last couple of weeks. I've done a couple of pieces, one on my favorite person, David Ortiz, one on GB Baseball and on Jose Fernandez. And Darius has done a huge playoff roundup and predictions and preview, which is going to be on the blog from tomorrow morning. So make sure you feast your eyes on that. Before we go, where can we find you all on Twitter? Tom, where can we find you?
So I'm at Pedroia's Face, as in the second baseman for the Boston Red Sox, at Pedroia's Face.
And Ben?
You can find me at UK Baseball Blog. It's my account for baseball stuff. If you want to read my other ramblings, I have a personal account at BenC34.
Great. And you can find me at Epouvantail, which is the French word for scarecrow, which is an even worse Twitter handle than Pedroia's Face. And you can find the Batflips and Nerds Twitter at Batflips_Nerds, at Batflips_Nerds. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/Batflips and Nerds. And you can send us an email, batflipsnerds@gmail.com. Please do. I just love getting emails from all of our listeners, and none of you have done it so far. And that's it. Join us again next time.